All right. We, as you know, have been studying miracles for some time. And so with our fifth class here this morning, we're about to make a really large transition in the history, the Old Testament history of the use of miracles. And so I wanted to add just a little bit to the material that we ended with last week and then sort of categorize it for you before we move on into this next century of miracles in the Old Testament. So kind of a little series of scriptures right here you might want to just jot down for future reference. But in understanding the relationship between these time frames and the government or the rule that God is using in these time frames. So with 1 Samuel chapter 7, verses 15 and 16, so I just put a portion on the screen here for you, but it summarizes in 1 Samuel 7, 15 and 16, that quote, "Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life." So in that passage, Samuel's job description, I guess, the activity that he's performing, is that of a judge. He judged Israel throughout his entire life. And of course, we know the unusual circumstances, even from birth, of how he was raised by Eli the priest and then eventually would become such a significant figure in Israel's history itself. However, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, in the very next chapter, at verses 4 through 7, "All the elders came to Samuel at Ramah and said, 'Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel. Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, 'Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them.'" So in this passage, we see two very different kind of governmental establishments. You've got the judges over here who are receiving direct revelation from God and are performing miracles, a few of them, as we'll see in a later chart here in a moment. And so we've got this time frame that is that of the judges. And then, of course, we're all familiar with these people looking around and wanting to have the same sort of notoriety or respect or whatever it was, you know, for the nations around them. A major problem, of course, that we have in the Lord's Church today when it comes to looking around at denominational churches, too, and, you know, longing maybe jealously for things that they have that are not really in either their best interest or necessarily ours. So you've heard sermons on along those lines before. But these people, they get to looking around them, you know, they feel some inadequacy in the Lord's program. And so now they want a king. But what do they want the king to do? They want the king to judge us like all the nations. And so they're looking for this figurehead to occupy some new relationship, some, you know, kind of invented form of government insofar as it goes for the Jews, because they're unsatisfied with being governed by the judges. So there's this transition that's going to take place. Samuel knows this is a bad idea. He prays to the Lord about it. The Lord agrees with him. It's a bad idea, but we're going to let them have it, and they're sure going to learn a lesson in the process. So they have rejected me, though, from being king. So in 1 Samuel 8, what we're learning is that throughout the period of the judges, God considered himself the only king, judge after judge after judge after judge. And the king, God, was informing those judges how they would make their rulings when the people came to them for their various problems or got attacked by another nation, needed a military leader or whatever. God was the king. These select men, they were the judges. And when they reject God's judges, then they're rejecting God's government and God's rule. So they are rejecting God from being their king. And whether they appreciate or understand it very well consciously, they're replacing God as king with some mere man, who, of course, is going to make lots of mistakes. That's just the nature of humankind, I guess. Now, again, 2 Kings chapter 23-22, such a Passover had not been celebrated from the days of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and of the kings of Judah. So I just splash this on the screen to take note again. The biblical history is taking notice, is identifying for us two different time periods. There's the time of the judges, there's the time of the kings. There's a, you know, there's a wall between those two. A terrible transition is taking place as we move from judges over into kings. Now, last week we did look at a couple of these next passages here, but the New Testament now adds these ideas in Acts 3, verses 24 and 25, quoting again, all the prophets who have spoken, that's not a judge, that's not a king, all the prophets who have spoken from Samuel and his successors onward also announced these days. Now, in light of the verses we've just seen, I'm thinking that he's not just saying God started giving them, you know, information about these days, starting with Samuel. While that may be true, I think still he's trying to point out something happened in Samuel. And from Samuel and his successors onward, God is thinking of them somehow in a special sense as the prophets. All the prophets who have spoken from Samuel and his successors onward also announced these days. Now, I'm going to take the time to do it. I thought about it. I got to look at it. I didn't think really want to spend, you know, so much time on it. So I'm just going to say that if you'll go back in your software or your printed concordance, look up all the occurrences of the word prophet or prophets in your Old Testament. I've never done that before. Just this week really surprised me. The word prophet or prophets is used very rarely. It is used. Moses is one. Aaron is one. We do have some that are called prophets prior to the time of Samuel. But after Samuel comes on the scene, that term just explodes. Now we see it all over the pages of the Old Testament. You know, and so, again, a transition is taking place. When we move from judges to kings, we're also moving from judges to prophets in some sense. So all the prophets who've spoken from Samuel and his successors, starts with Samuel, announced these days. The other passage we saw is also in the book of Acts, the 10 chapters later, chapter 13. When he destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan, he distributed their land as an inheritance, which took about 450 years. After these things, he gave them judges until Samuel, who has a designator. He's Samuel the what? Samuel the prophet. So again, there's this indication that God viewed this selfish and foolish desire of the Old Testament Jews to have a king is a terrible idea. But we're going to make that transition. We're going to teach them this lesson. And then there's Samuel and his successors, starting with the days of those kings. So here's my summary then. Samuel is not the first prophet, but if you will, he's the first of the prophets in this categorical kind of a sense, where God is looking at a time frame in the Old Testament history and saying, well, Samuel and his successors, I'm going to put in a separate category. By the way, there's another passage, I think it's in 2 Kings, and again, I didn't want to take time with it, but just to point out, a very fascinating, you know, little statement that these people used to be called seers, the passage says, S-E-E-R-S, there weren't very many of them, and now they're called prophets. So you can look it up yourself, you don't want to take time, and I'm not going to, but there is also a statement about a difference in the term seer as opposed to prophet. Though there wasn't much more information, I don't think I can elaborate on it. The scripture still took note of it. So again, there's this transition taking place. Samuel, then, is in some sense the first of this group that God's calling the prophets, and Saul, simultaneously, is what? He's the first of the kings. So, very jarringly different circumstances for this new time frame in Old Testament history. Comes Saul, first king, human king. This is a change in the way God is going to relate to these people, the Jews. Now, I'm really glad I did this. I was a little bit afraid of putting it up front. Now, ordinarily, than summarizing this chart that we've been adding to week by week. I'm glad that, for the sake of all of our visitors here, that I just chose kind of arbitrarily to put it at the front today. But what we've already seen is that in the time of Abraham, when we have the establishment of a new people, the chosen people of God, all the descendants of Abraham are going to become our Hebrews, those sojourners, the Jews. And then we have Moses in a time frame difference of about 400 years with this new people now receive this new law. And the law that they receive in Moses is very unique. It is now going to be written down. It's quite extensive. God hasn't been dealing in the same way with anybody up to this time. So we now have this very sophisticated, codified law that Moses brings, and in that time frame, again, we have miracles. Miracles, Abraham's time, miracles in Moses' time. Then we come to Joshua. And by the way, I'm just putting this chart up for those of you who were in previous classes. I changed these terms just a little bit. But now we have this new land. The new people, with the new law, after 40 years of wilderness wandering, come into their promised land. They receive, you know, their geographical boundaries now. And so when they come into the land, we have a flurry of miracles. Then we have Gideon as a judge. We have miracles. Samson, of course, as a judge, we have miracles. And by the way, they're the only two. You got a whole lot of judges where there aren't any miracles being performed. But with those two, there are. Then you come to Samuel. So we've just been talking about it. New term is kind of introduced. Prophets been used, but rarely. Now we've got prophets. And we're going to be looking at this morning now the time of Elijah and Elisha. Now these men are contemporaries. Elisha's the younger man who'll take over after Elijah, but they're back to back. And it's then, you know, a single time frame. And now we have the kings as well. In each of these cases, something's really changing, except that Gideon and Samson are both judges. And then with Samuel, we're moving into the time of the kings. But you see, something new and very significant has arisen. But Abraham's in the 1900s, Moses is in the 1400s, Joshua also, there again you have a successor, so they knew each other, immediate, the same time frame. Judges, Gideon is in the 1200s, but Samson's a century later in the 1100s. Samuel is a century later. Elijah and Elisha, as we're about to see, are two centuries later in the 800s. So, what we've been picking up is this realization that over the course of all these centuries, we're now spanning more than a millennium from Abraham to Elisha, 1,100 years. Are miracles a constant throughout all this time? You kind of think so when you're reading your Old Testament. Are there miracles in the first five books? Yes, there are. There are miracles in the next book, Joshua. Yes, there are. There are miracles in the next book, Judges. Yes, there are. So as you're reading along, you might be excused for thinking, well, God's always working miracles. But when you put it in a chart form like this, not at all. He skips five centuries, and then two, and then one, and then another one, and then he skips two more centuries. What you have is very effectively rare and localized, historically, very focused periods of time when you have miracles. And when you have the miracles, is it notable? Doesn't it kind of just jump off the page now? Some very significant change is taking place in God's plans, in the way God relates to humankind, in the way God is revealing himself. When there's a new people, you got miracles. When there's a new law, you got miracles. When you go into a new land, you have miracles. When you have the judges, you got miracles to establish those men. And then you have these prophets with Samuel during, as we're about to see, the period of the kings. But the period of the kings is a dramatic shaking of the way God has been ruling over his people. And he tells them so. You're rejecting me as a king to go get these men, and so we're going to change some things up. Miracles then, brethren, are a very unusual thing in the great span of this over a millennium of Old Testament history. And when you see them, they're emphasizing something. Something dramatic is going on. Now, let's come on over and look at Elijah this morning. Each of these previous four classes, again this morning, we just want to look at the miracles. I've been using a list that was created by Norman Geisler, a rather famous scholar, been around quite a while now, wrote I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and When Skeptics Ask, and a number of books like those. Not a member of the church, but a fine scholar. And so I've been using his particular list of all the miracles in the Bible, and so we'll just be following that again. But have we looked at every miracle? No. We're skipping a lot. And so you can go back yourself, study each and every one that if you like. If you like to have that list, I can provide it for you. You can find it online easy enough. Just Geisler's list of miracles will pop right up. But this morning, especially, we're going to be looking at the fewer, not every one of the miracles that take place. But I've chosen particular ones because of statements that are made about them. So, everybody open your Bibles now. We're not going to be putting anything up on the screen. But you've got to get back to 1 Kings, the first book of Kings, and chapter 17 now. 1 Kings 17. As you can see on the list right there, you may probably remember that Elisha's a Tishbite. He's among the settlers of Gilead in verse 1, and he's working with King Ahab. Is Ahab a good king or a bad king? A very bad king. Is he a king of the north or a king of the south? Is he with the 10 tribes in the north or the 2 in the south? Ahab. He's in the north. And so, and Ahab's most associated with what city that actually you wouldn't think of, north. And most 10 tribes, in the north. But he's in what city? Samaria. So because of the three New Testament designations of Galilee, Samaria, and Judea, we kind of think of him as being in the middle. But he was ruling over, the north, the northern 10 tribes. So here we are in this time frame. In 1 Kings chapter 17 and verse 4, it shall be that you shall drink of the brook, and I've commanded the ravens to provide for you there. So he goes and he does this. If you read on into verse 6, you'll find out that morning and evening the ravens are bringing him meat. They're bringing him food to eat. Now, no doubt about it, that's miraculous. Very few people, get fed by wild animals and birds flying down and dropping off lunch. Breakfast and dinner. But who's seeing it? And in this case, at the very start of these Elijah's, or the miracles of Elijah, there's no notation made, I don't believe, of anybody seeing it. So he sees how he's been being treated, but nobody else does. Now, same chapter, just skip 10 verses, look at verse 14. And again, I'm skipping. We're not looking at every single verse of a given event either. But in 17:14, thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be empty until the day the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth. Well, it isn't going to rain for 3 years. That's another story. But, during that length of time, then, for this woman, there's an inexhaustible supply of flour and oil. Will she see this? See, now you have a witness to supernatural powers that are revolving around an individual who is a representative of God. Elijah is our prophet. Now, let's get, again, in the same chapter, though, 1 Kings 17, made it easier for you here, too, you know, selecting not just the first ones, but all in one chapter. And chapter 17 now at verse 22. The Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child returned to him, and he revived, and then he gives it back to his mother. So here we have an Old Testament resurrection. It's not the only Old Testament resurrection, but it is a resurrection. And by most people's just simple rationale, and I believe thanks to Romans 1, an actual statement, is there any miracle that can be greater than raising somebody from the dead? There's just none. Now, any miracle is supernatural. But when you raise somebody from the dead, it is not just superior power over natural things that people see every day, but it is a supernatural power over someone who has exited the physical creation, who has died, and therefore, to say it's rare is the understatement, you know, of all time, they've passed into the realm of the unseen. What power does any human have over that? Can't understand it, can't even see it, and now they're coming back even from the dead. So just in our old minds, we would say, yeah, that is unusual, to say the least, even in the realm of miracles. Of course, Romans 1 tells us that's how Jesus is designated to be the Son of God. Okay, so we have a miracle of resurrection. That's going to get Mom's attention, and she's not likely to keep that to herself. So people are going to find out, this Elijah, he is one rare kind of a human being. Now, let's summarize. And I chose this chapter for a couple of different reasons, but particularly because of that 24th verse. What does the 24th verse say? What does she say? Sees the miracle. Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is what? Truth. Now, those of you that have been in our class the preceding 4 weeks, what have we been discovering about miracles? They are emphasizing that this individual who's involved with these miracles is a direct representative from God. And here it is, yet again. She says, now I know this. Do you suppose that with the inexhaustible flour and oil that she should have been waking up to this idea? Yeah, I'd say so. Okay. But, you know, how readily would you accept a miracle? I'm naturally kind of suspicious of God, you know, anyway. Maybe you are too. You suppose maybe she might have said, well, I can't figure out how he's doing this, but he must be sneaking out at night while I'm sleeping or something, and I sure appreciate it. But can you see how she might have rationalized a naturalistic explanation for the inexhaustible flour and oil? Yeah, you know, at least you could argue that. Okay? But now, does she know who her boy is? Does she know if he lives or dies? Does she know that this is a resurrection? Is there any way you could fake this? She's witness to this event. So whatever she was getting before, I think it was significant. I think she recognized him, you know, as some sort of representative of God. But still, this miracle is just in a class of its own. And she says, now I know. You are a man of God. That's point number one. You're a man of God. And the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth. I'm impressed with you. I'm impressed also with the message that you bring. I see what you say is different and superior. Now, let's add another one from Elijah, still continuing with Elijah, and going now into 1 Kings chapter 18. So, everybody knows this chapter. 1 Kings 18. You know, I'm looking ahead and I think maybe I made a mistake here. Yeah. Okay. In 1 Kings 18, let's read verses 21 through, it should be 24. I made two mistakes in my numbering, but it should be 18, 21 through 24. So the whole chapter is devoted to this. I've just got to, you know, pick and choose. But in 21, Elijah came near to all the people. You can see from 20, we're on Mount Carmel. He said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" Now, what's the problem before we go any further? What's the problem? The people are, the word's hesitant, but what does it mean? Between two opinions, they're, yeah, they're undecided. They can't make up their minds. They're flip-flopping. They're not committed. They haven't made a choice, and so they can't stick to a choice you've never made. They're just kind of fumbling and bumbling here, and it's unacceptable. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long? You hesitate between two opinions. If..." Now, by the way, I've emphasized this an awful lot in my classes, maybe the visitors, I presume, probably know this anyway, but just to point out, in the New American Standard, my personally preferred translation, probably in some other translations too, whenever you see the word Lord in all capitals, see, it says Lord is God. God has a capital G, but not a capital O or D. But Lord is all capitals. Why do they do that? This is a convention that points out something in the New American Standard. It helps us, I think, tremendously. Why would Lord be in all caps? I'm sorry, a little bit louder. Yahweh. This is this personal name of God, sometimes translated the Jehovah. The Tetragrammaton had four consonants and no vowels. And so, but it's the name of God. It is often, more often, translated Lord. But there's another word for Lord, and when you see that word Lord, it'll have a capital L, but lowercase O-R-D. So to help us out, what this says is, if Yahweh is God, if Jehovah is God, if that God whose name I just spoke but translated Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. So here they are, you know, they're yo-yos, up and down, trying to decide, and all of a sudden, you know, Elijah, he just grabs that yo-yo on the upswing there, and they go, stops everybody here. So they can't answer. He says, "Choose," and they just freeze. Nobody says a word. Then Elijah, 22, said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of Yahweh, but Baal's prophets are 450 men." So the two names are being used of these rival gods. "Now let them," 23, "give us two oxen, let them choose one ox for themselves, cut it up, place it on the wood, put no fire under it. I'll prepare the other ox, lay it on the wood, and I will not put fire under it. And then you call the name of your God, I'll call on the name of Yahweh. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered and said, "That's a good idea." All right, so let's have a test. We'll finally, you know, stop flip-flopping. We can see some demonstration now. Now, see, I'm skipping a long way now, but now we go to 36. Same chapter, verse 36 through 39. 36. "Came about at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet," he's Elijah the what? And since Samuel, what are we looking at? Prophet. So it's like a title now. He's Elijah the prophet. "Came near and said, O Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel," Jacob's other name, "today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and," what? "That I am your servant, and that I've done all these things at your word." So you know the story. Fire came down from heaven, even though his sacrifice had even been doused with water, and burns it all up, and so we know who God is. 1 Kings 17:36. Look at it again. Came about time of the evening offering. Elijah the prophet is praying, O Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known what? Your God in Israel, and I am your servant. So why do we do all of this? When you have a miracle, very prodigious one in this case, very impressive one, how many guys are going to die because of it? Take 450 prophets of Baal down there to the Kishon, and I stood on Mount Carmel and got to see right at the foot of the hill there, you can see the trail of the little Kishon Brook there in the Jezreel Valley. And so, let it be known. You're the God, I'm your servant, and how many of these false prophets and their priests are we going to tolerate? None of them. So, is that emphatic? Does that miracle have some emphasis? We're saying, well, of course it does. It's pretty amazing, as a matter of fact, that its purpose is stated, oh, I know, God and his servant. Okay, now Elisha, same time frame, disciple and servant to Elijah in 2 Kings. So skip a book, or go to the next book, and come to the first part of 2 Kings, the second chapter then. So let's pick up with him. Now I'm skipping a bunch of miracles, but we got the point of Elijah and God's work in miracles through him. Now 2 Kings 2. 2 Kings 2 starting in 13 through 16. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and returned and stood by the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and struck the waters and said, where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the waters, they were divided here and there, and Elisha crossed over. Now, if the waters of the Jordan River are divided so that they're here and they're there, then what have you got? You got a wall. How many times do waters get divided in Scripture? What's the first one?
Red Sea.
Red Sea. What's the second one? Crossing this Jordan when they come into the Promised Land, led by Joshua. But here's a third time. This happens when Elisha is, we say, taking up the mantle. That's where that expression comes from. You take up the mantle. You take up the cloak that represented then of the office and the responsibilities of your predecessor. Okay, so in verse, where did I leave off here? 13 through 16, the mantle struck through 15. Now, when the sons of the prophets were at Jericho opposite him, saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. And they came to meet him and bowed themselves to the ground before him. And they said, behold now, there are with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and search for your master. Perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him up, cast him in. And he said, you shall not sin. Who's taken over? And what do the people see? The Spirit on this guy now. It's on Elisha. And these are the sons of the prophets. And I'm not sure in that passage exactly what that means. If it's other prophets, if it's children of prophets, or if it's the people that listen to the prophets. But for our purposes this morning, it doesn't matter who they are. They're witnesses, and what's the point they get? Elisha is the new guy. He's the new one. He's the new prophet. So the Jordan River's parted. Now, a little later in the same chapter, 2 Kings chapter 2, 19. Men of the city said to Elisha, behold now, the situation of the city is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water's bad, and the land is unfruitful. This is now Jericho, verse 18. And in 20, he said, bring me a new jar, put salt in it. So they brought it to him. He went after the spring of water, and threw salt in it, and said, thus says the Lord, that's Yahweh, I've purified these waters, there shall not be from there death or unfruitfulness any longer. So the waters have been purified to this day according to the word of Elisha which he spoke. Now, of course, 2 Kings was written a long time ago. But to this day, once again, those of you who've been there, you know, there's a very famous spring still flowing at Jericho to this day. The waters are pure to this day, drink the waters to this day. You know, it was the time, this day of the writing that book, 2 Kings, but even now. Brother, in the history of humankind and water, can you take poisonous water where people die if they drink it? You know, all you have to do is take a jar of salt and pour it in there and everything's okay. That just doesn't happen. So, in the cleansing of the spring, the people asked for this. And they get a very dramatic miracle that is life-saving. Now, let's rush on. We've got to go to 2 Kings now, chapter 5. 2 Kings 5, and we're going to read verses 8 through 15. A little longer passage here, but 2 Kings 5, 8. Happened when Elisha, the man of God, what's he now, what title is he now bearing? He's the man of God. How'd they figure that out? The miracles that he was performing. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent word to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me and you shall know that there's a prophet in Israel." So, Naaman came with his horses, his chariots, and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go, wash in the Jordan 7 times, your flesh will be restored to you and you shall be clean." Now you all know the story. I'm rushing, but you know the story. Naaman, Jew or Gentile? Gentile, Naaman. What's his problem? He's got leprosy. Has anything else worked? No. He's got power, money, means. So he's seeking help. He's heard about this guy, Elisha. And so, help me out. Does Elisha show him any kind of respect or even really take notice of him? No. You know, I've got one of these Ring doorbell things, you know. So you come into my yard, it's got a motion detector, and it rings inside the house before you even get to the door. And then when you get to the door, if you ring the doorbell, I get a different kind of a ring. And my phone comes alive, and the camera that's inside there, activates. And on my phone, I can not only see that person there, but I can talk to them. There's a microphone on my phone. There's a speaker on the ring thing. They connect to each other. I could be in Tasmania and talk to the mail carrier if I need to when they come to my door, which is really cool. Okay, but if you come to my door and you ring my doorbell, and then I just kind of shout through the door, "Well, you know, take care of it that way." What am I saying to you? Some kind of a reason why I can't come. And you would think, well, the poor guy is sick, you know, something like that. But if you're a powerful, influential kind of an individual who deserves, you know, respect, you know, if Donald Trump or somebody, you know, like that comes to my door, and I just shout to the door, "You know, I don't have time for you." Am I making a point? And you take offense. What was, you know, they made a big story out of it. It's such a nothing burger, you know, but apparently Donald Trump stepped in front of the Queen this week. You hear about that? Oh, boy, it's blazing all over the news, you know, like the guy shot her in the head and then kicked her or something, you know. And, you know, I did, apparently, somehow he managed to step in front of the Queen of England, you know, and it's all right. So he broke protocol. But when he broke the protocol, what happened? Well, it lit up the whole Internet. You know, he broke protocol. He didn't show proper respect. I can't blame, you know, Naaman here. When, in verse 11, he's furious. And he went away and he said, "Behold, I thought he'll surely come out to me, stand, call on the name of the Lord his God." Now note, the word Lord is what? See, call on the name of Yahweh his God. So he's been doing his homework and he's been learning. He knows what God we're talking about here. And waved his hand over the place, you know, cured the leper, but Arnot, Abana, and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel. He's from Syria. "Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. And then his servants came near, and they spoke to him. They said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? Why much more than when he says to you, wash and be clean? He's making it easy. You know, you're all upset, but you know, it's really just a simple thing. And he didn't ask for a bunch of money, and he didn't ask for you to, you know, sacrifice 47 cattle, you know, which would be so expensive. All he said was, go and wash, why don't you try it? So on 14, he went down, he dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the what? According to the word of the man of God. Brethren, these designators are not there by accident. All the things that might have been said or not said, God put something in there, you know, you take notice. You thought, well, huh, why'd you add that? He could have just said the word of Elisha, but he didn't. This is the point that's being made. Man of God as opposed to others. Flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. Healthier and younger than he was before. And he returned to the man of God with all his company, came and stood before him. He said, behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please, take a present from your servant now. Did he get the point? Yeah. And in 5:8, we've already seen it, and now we're seeing it again. What is Elisha? Who is Yahweh? God and prophet. And there's no other in Israel. Now, I have at the end right here, it's the 5-minute warning, the bell that you just heard. There's one anomaly in all of this. I'm not quite sure what to make out of it, but there is this one very unique thing. So we've just come through the 800s. We've seen Elijah and Elisha. Another 100 years or thereabouts later, we have Isaiah's one lonely miracle in 2 Kings 20. So you come to the 20th chapter of this same book now. And in 2 Kings 20, verses 8 through 11, Hezekiah is sick. He asks Isaiah, what will be the sign that the Lord will heal me? Lord's in all caps. That I shall go up to the house of Yahweh the third day. Now Isaiah said, this will be the sign to you from Yahweh, that Yahweh will do the thing he's spoken, and shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or back? Hezekiah said, he's for shadow to decline 10 steps, and I'll let the shadow turn backwards. Isaiah the prophet cried, Yahweh, he brought shadow on the stairway back 10 steps, by which it was gone down on the stairway of Ahaz. So, in 2 Kings 20, and in verse 8, it's the sign, what? That the Lord will heal me. Now, we're wrapping up the Old Testament right here. A little bit next week, but we're wrapping up the Old Testament. We're going to the New next week. That sign, all by itself, is a little bit different than the others, isn't it? Now, Hezekiah has apparently already accepted Isaiah as a prophet and without miracles. Now, in this personal moment, he wants some kind of confirmation about him being healed. What's in his mind, and does he think that his healing would be miraculous? Does he believe he has a fatal disease? I don't know. I don't know what's going on in his head. But he asks for a sign, for whatever reason. And it's granted to him. It's also, you know, I wanted to put it up here because it is Isaiah, and it does involve another guy, and Isaiah is present. But it's one of those miracles, and again, fellow visitors, that I've been ignoring as a group altogether. When God in His sovereign power does something, it's not necessarily directly related to a man. We've been ignoring those. God does a lot of things. There have been miracles, you know, about as rare as the ones we've seen, though. But, you know, I'm just involving the ones that have to do with somebody down here. Well, Isaiah's involved, but still it really is a what? On that very lengthy multi-page list that Geister made of all miracles in the Bible, I've been writing in the margin, AOG for the insurance company's term, AOG Act of God. Okay. So it's kind of singular, but you know, I'll put it up there. You know, Hezekiah seems to have accepted it. Isaiah is kind of involved, but essentially it's just a direct what? Act of God. So now we'll just close, as I have with every lesson at some point. My favorite definition of a miracle is the one by this guy Easton that you can find in two dictionaries, Baker's and the Illustrated Bible Dictionary. Lots of people define miracles. But in the midst of his paragraph on definition, he said this about them. They are designed to authenticate the divine commission of a religious teacher and what? The truth of his message. So, in Genesis now, not just through 1 Samuel, but into Kings and all the way to Isaiah this morning, Abraham's new people, Moses' new law, Joshua's new land, Gideon and Samson as judges, Samuel as the prophets, and then with Elijah and Elisha as kings, and Isaiah in the time of the kings. What we've got is the 1900s, the 1400s, the 12s, the 11s, the 10s, the 8s, and the 7s with Isaiah. I'm sorry, my font sizes went wrong. Ted and I talked about it again this morning. But what are the miracles doing? Are they just because God feels bad that somebody's got cancer and so he's going to answer their prayer so they alone can be healthy and happy? That is not why God does miracles, is it? Not why. Even when Naaman gets his leprosy cured, what's he figuring out? God. And who's he? Representative of the whole nation of Syria, not just a sick guy in Israel. Okay? Thank you for the extra minute. Class dismissed.